The KM Football Podcast. Exclusive interviews with the biggest names in Kent football.
Welcome to the KM Football Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Panting, and for the last time, Aussie-bound Steve Turvett has joined me on the road trip to meet this week's special guest. He played in all four tiers of the Football League, winning at Wembley along the way, and his form at club level saw him called up by the Republic of Ireland. Supporters of Cambridge United, Birmingham and Coventry will remember him as one of football's hard men. A true leader on the pitch, he took his first steps in management with Havant and Waterlooville, briefly in charge at Welling, before arriving at Gravesend and Northfleet in 2005. He lifted the FA Trophy 3 years later, led the Fleet to promotion in 2011, and went on to become the longest-serving manager in the club's history. We are, of course, talking about Liam Daish, so welcome to the podcast, Liam, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to see you. You're in Portsmouth attire, so we should really ask, what are you doing now in football? You've been away from first team management 4 or 5 years now, so what have you been doing with your time since?
Going on a lot of courses and re-educating myself a little bit and doing other things on the side to keep ticking over. But I'm now presently professional development phase coach for the under-18s at Portsmouth, which I'm enjoying immensely, and going into more of a development role than the performance, if you like.
How did you get into that role, specifically at Portsmouth, but into the youth football section?
I started off working. I went into a college, Brockenhurst College, down in the New Forest, and they were advertising for a. They're quite a sport-minded college, and they were looking for a football coach to look after that department, and I went in there and started enjoying that and get a bit of success with the lads, and you know, that was good. And then I heard that there was a couple of jobs coming up in Portsmouth, which I applied for. I didn't get the one that I applied for, but they obviously saw something in the interview, and they invited me back and done some part-time work, and then slowly went in an assistant, and now I'm the lead phase and full time down there. Been down there just over 2 years now.
Is it great to see the players at that age develop and you can see improvements in their game? Is that the biggest satisfaction from that job?
Yeah, it is, and it's come full circle where I started. I started at Portsmouth as an apprentice and made my first team debut there, and it's just come full circle where I've come back to where it all started for me, and probably sort of helping the younger lads and pass on a little bit of experience of what to do and what not to do going forward, and trying to help them. And it's good. There's quite a lot to it. It's not just basically taking a bag of balls out now and setting up a session for a bunch of 18-year-olds. We look at developing the person, and obviously, in today's climate, the success rate of what players go on to make full professionals is low. So we concentrate that, you know, that hopefully out of the two, when they come out the two-year program, or from their time in the academy, they come out as sort of well-equipped human being who can deal with all the challenges of life going forward, and not be, you know, stranded and struggling and dealing with not being able to be a professional footballer.
How different is this job to what you've done previously with first teams?
There's some similarities, but not a lot. Obviously, managing personalities is similar, but you know, the performance side, where you know, in first team is all about wins and getting that win on a Saturday or a Tuesday night. So where, you know, what I do now is probably help develop, where probably it's still important and we all love to win, but looking at more the development side of players on the pitch and off the pitch, it's a little bit different.
Are there elements that you miss in terms of going out and playing for 3 points? And on the flip side, I bet there's stuff that you're glad you've left behind.
Yeah, there is that. I do sometimes miss the buzz of a Saturday. Although, you know, my experiences have been sort of in my last bit of football club management you know, turned me off of it quite a bit. But I still miss that, you know, dealing with men instead of sort of 18-year-olds where things can be a little bit up and down. And, it, you know, I have to pinch myself sometimes, put myself in check that I am dealing with a 16 or 17 or 18, not someone who's going out trying to get you 3 points. And but I'm getting better at that.
You mentioned that it's come full circle. Take us back to when you were in the boots of these young lads that you're working with now, starting off with Pompey.
Yeah, I started back, signed in 85. Alan Ball was the manager. He gave me my... I was an apprentice for schoolboy, then apprentice. Got signed as a professional, 2 years. Made my debut. Played for my hometown club. Final year, had a bad year with injuries and got a little bit lost. And then got released, and that's when I went and sort of had to go and stand on my feet a little bit. But had some great times at Portsmouth, met some great characters. Obviously, World Cup winner gave me debut, and big personalities in change room, a bit different to it now, different culture. But yeah, it sort of like set me up a little, I think, you know, being involved in a club as a local boy at my hometown club in Portsmouth, which, you know, with all respect, is quite a hardened town, and learned a lot of lessons along the way.
When you look back now, are you disappointed that you only played once for Portsmouth?
I am, and I am not. You know, I think there was a real opportunity for the football club and me, to be fair, but sometimes things don't happen. I think I went away on my first holiday abroad a year as a pro. I went away in the summer, came back, wasn't well, never recovered in pre-season, didn't have a good pre-season, broke a bone in my foot, and it was just all stop start. And you know, I'd made my debut the year before, and there was all, you know, big aspirations and things were going, and it just sort of like, you know, like football does, 1 minute you're riding a wave, and the next minute you sort of it all comes tumbling down. But you know, looking back now, you know, getting out of my hometown, getting away, moving up to Cambridge, where I had an absolutely fabulous 5-6 years, met great people, had great success as a player at that club, and you know, so it swings and roundabouts. Yes, I would have liked to play more games for my hometown club, of course I would, but looking back, you know, it was probably a good thing that I got out of where I was. You know, I come from a place just outside Portsmouth, an estate which at that time, in them days, you know, you could soon get into trouble a little bit, and probably I needed to get away and find my own feet and you know, work it out for myself and grow up a little bit.
So how much did moving up to Cambridge United shape you, not just as a player but a person?
Greatly. You know, I remember that summer I was waiting for the phone to ring. I was that season I turned down and moved to Carlisle for a fee, and it was too far away from Portsmouth, so I turned that down. I was interested from Leicester, which didn't curtail, and then at the end of the season, Pompey had 1 year in the old First Division, or now Premier League. They got relegated in their first year, so that end of that summer, at the end of that season, there was a big clear out. There was loads of players just got released, and I was one of them. And you're waiting for the phone to ring, and I got a phone call from John Beck, who was Chris Turner's assistant, who asked me to come up. I came up, signed for 2 years. I was in Diggs with a family in a village just outside Cambridge. And yeah, then it went from there, from a little bed to a tiny little bedsit room. And but you know, at that time I wasn't the only one. There was maybe 7 or 8 free transfers in that team that had been released from bigger clubs. You know, good players. You know, likes of, we went on, Alan Kimball, Dion Dublin, Phil Chappell. You know, we'd all been released from so-called bigger clubs, got a little bit lost in the system, you know, where we were young prospect, but not probably quite there for first team, but still very young. And we were given a chance of first team football. And we all knew that, you know, we'd been released once from sort of bigger clubs, so-called bigger clubs. We'd all been released, and this was a second chance, and we were all up for making the most of it, because, you know, when if you get released from Cambridge in them days, which were, I think, the first thing I looked at was the paper of where they finished at the end of the last season, and it was like third, fourth from bottom of the old fourth. So, you know, there was a reality check there that we had to, you know, start. This was a chance, and we were all in it together, and it was the start of a real great 4 or 5 years.
Over the space of three seasons, you went from the old fourth division to the verge of what is now the Premier League, the playoffs in the old Division Two. What are your memories of that time, and what made it such a successful side?
Bit of everything, really. A real tactical, clever manager. The first one was the recruitment, which was, you know, Chris Turner, who started, who the ex-Peterborough manager, who's sadly died now, but he started it all. John Beck took it on, was totally out of the box with his training ideas and methods, although now, if you compared with him now, he was before his time, regarding things like diets and stats and analysis and training regimes and pre-seasons, far ahead of the game. So there was him, good young players that were hungry, and a togetherness and a team spirit that we really wanted to achieve, and we did, and you know, we were that close to going into the top league within three seasons.
You mentioned John Beck there. My recollection at the time, it was almost a ridiculement amongst national media. Is that be a fair way that Cambridge were looked upon from the outside? Because you was the unfashionable club in terms of the style of play, some of the publicity you got off the field as well, in terms of John's methods. Is that fair?
And yeah, harsh, probably. I think because it was all new, and he was, he was ahead of the game. He worked on small percentages of how he could get them small percentages to make a difference, and he worked on everything from you know, whether it was free kicks, corners, how we were going to play, down to sizes of pitches, how the grass was grown, where the keeper kicked, diet, stretching, psychology, fitness. It was just a whole, you know, everything together, and he took that very tactically aware, and we just, you know, two teams couldn't deal with us, and I think there was a little bit of arrogance of sort of, because we turned over big. I remember once we beat Ipswich at Portman Road to go top of the old second division, and it was like, you know, they didn't like it. Teams didn't like it playing, I remember Glenn Oddall at Swindon. He was manager at Swindon, the purist and a great footballer, and but you know, quite derogatory and what we. But it didn't bother us. We were gaining points. We were earning win bonus. We were enjoying each other's company, and I wouldn't say we were all on Becky's best mate, but he knew what he was doing in a way that it pulled us closer together, even if it was to show him a little bit. You know, he was very clever in that way, and that was a big thing psychologically. He was very ahead and knew what he was doing there, and he knew how to bring teams together. What they call that when you're you gather together and you become a little bit of a siege mentality. I think it was that siege mentality, us against them, and you know, we were very good at it, and yeah, had some great times. Didn't earn a lot of money there. We weren't on great money, but it was looked at as a stepping stone as well to bigger and better things.
I was going to say, history does say that you played with some great players in that team as well, because of where your careers all went.
Yeah, and they were good players. You know, that's you know, as much as we talk about, or people talk about John Beck's tactics, his mythology, and things like that, you still had to have good players to be able to put that in place. And, you know, that Chris Turner needs to take a lot of credit for that, because he brought in, you know, Phil Chappell, Alan Kimball, John Taylor, Steve Claridge, I think, might have come with Becky. Dion Dublin was signed by Chris Turner, Chris Ledbetter, Michael Cheatham, Lee Philpott. You know, these all went on and played at a really good level, higher up. So, and that was the recruitment. And he had a good nucleus of players. And I don't care who you are, you know, it is about you're as good as your players. And, you know, he had a good blend there.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
For all the success that you had at Cambridge, did the move to Birmingham take your career to a different level?
Yeah, it did, I think so. Size of club was just, you know, blew it out of the water a little bit. But I moved to Birmingham and instantly found that it was like, this is what I was striving to be at a club like that, where there was real expectation and real pressure and real partisan crowds. And, you know, it was something that, oh, I'm at a club now, this means business. And, you know, again, another great chapter.
Barry Fry was in the dugout. The club was owned by Gold Sullivan and Karen Brady. Just paint a picture of what Birmingham City was like at that time.
I remember driving up, and Baz had, I'd played for Barry at Barnet when I first signed for Cambridge. I went on loan for a little while at Cambridge, which was another great experience with he'd worked with Stan Flashman then. That was the chairman. So that was another great experience and different. But Baz remembered me from there and was always interested in me. I agreed a fee. I went up there and signed. And obviously, so you've got David Sullivan, the Golds, Karen, Baz at the middle of it, signing players here, there and everywhere. You know, there was a joke that there was revolving doors that were signing, that they'd put in for players to go out and players to come in. It was a bit of a madhouse. It was, you know, it was chaotic. But again, good players at Nucleus, when Baz got his team together, when Barry got his team together, there was a good set of players that whatever was going on around you, and there was always arguments, there was always rows, there was always in-house fights, there's always something going on behind the scenes. Barry was always at loggerheads with either a Karen, or Karen was at loggerheads with Barry, or David Sullivan was having but the players just sort of, like, for some reason, or some, you know, somehow kept their mentality in focus of trying to you know, win a game on a Saturday. But it was chaotic at times.
It sounded like a lot of fun while you were there, but there were some real strong personalities within that changing room. How important was that?
I think any changing room is about strong personalities, and I think, you know, when it gets like that, I think it helps the manager. And I know for a fact from my own experience that if you've got strong personalities in your changing room, it makes your job a lot easier, because if they're on board with you, the changing room looks after itself. You don't have to go in there and sort out any little squabbles and all that sort of, and that's what we had at Birmingham. Strong team, strong individuals, good players, winners, and you know, it was a tough club, tough fans, and a tough changing room there. And you know, we were a good side. We could play, but you know, we could mix it as well. And you know, the first year when I arrived in February, and I think we had 14 games left. We won something like 9 of them. Or 8 of them, drew 3, lost 2, and went down. So we went down from the Championship to what is League One now. Or from there, you know, we came off. I remember we lost at Tranmere. We actually, our fans come on the pitch and put us on their shoulders, taking them off, and we just got relegated. It was amazing. And then the next year we bounced back. The pressure was on us then. We had to win that league. We won the league, and then obviously won at Wembley in the auto windscreen as well, in front of 80,000, which was amazing. So within a year, it was tough, because everybody wanted to beat Birmingham, and we got back to the Championship.
Do you see a difference in how footballers are now and the players in that era?
Yeah, Yeah, I don't think they're as fragile. They weren't as fragile in them days. I think they were more self-sufficient. They could work things out for themselves a little bit more. I think they were a little bit more honest with themselves as well. They didn't look across the, you know, across the room. If they had a bad game, they don't add to it. They weren't looking to put blame. I see a little bit of a blame culture in football. I think good players will always look at themselves first and honest players. But I think they weren't as fragile as they are now today. You know, I look at. There's a lot of managing with players nowadays where I think players in my era got on with it and were pretty honest with their own evaluation.
I don't think our younger listeners will remember or know much about the Anglo-Italian Cup, but you played in that for Birmingham. It was quite an infamous competition at times, wasn't it? Just remind us what that was like.
Yeah, we played Ancona. Barry got us on a flight to Italy. We were playing Ancona in the Italian Cup. Anglo-Italian Cup. We went over there again. Me, a team of lads, a manager, a kit man, a trainer, a physio, and that was it. No security, nothing. So we go into a foreign country, we play this game, it all kicks off. It escalates out after the game in the tunnel, in the communal changing areas, it gets worse, incidents happen. Before you know it, it's all blown up, and people, including myself, are trying to or look to be extradited to face charges in Italy, which, you know, all blew over in the end, thankfully. But yeah, that got a bit silly. But
was that all from like a tackle in the game or something?
It was all to do with a trainer that for the Italian side who. For any excuse to get on the pitch and grab one of our players by the throat, he did. And this went on and on and on and on and on. And anyway, we won the game and that was the end of it. And then it was one of them stadiums where you walk down pitch side, literally below the pitch, and then go up into this communal area where there was two changing rooms. And I got separated because I thought that's the end of the game. I'm getting off now. I want to get home. And ended up finding myself in amongst a group of Italians and Mr. Trainer, who wants to now sort of grab me by the throat. So it all got a little bit, you know, as it does. And then the next thing, it's, you know, well, it blew over for a while. And it wasn't until I got I moved to Coventry that I got a letter that sent to me that they wanted me to come stand trial in Italy for an incident that had happened 2 years previous. So yeah, but that's I don't put it this way. I have no interest in visiting Italy ever again.
You haven't booked any holidays to
Ancona? No. My wife wants to go to Rome, but she won't be going with me.
Just reading about that game, that incident, it was very much you all had to stick together, didn't you, as players when it was kicking off?
Yeah, well, that was it. Yeah, and that's what you did in them days, you know. And I suppose they still do it to them, but it was a lot of things were left to, they didn't have the cameras and the, you know, phone cameras and the what goes on around a game now, so there was a lot going on. And yeah, it was quite interesting. But again, afterwards, we were on the bus and there's police and everything, flashing lights, people being led out and all that. And, you know, it was just one of them. We're in a foreign country here now. We have no one. I've got Barry Fry to represent me and look after me. Am I ever going to get out of this?
He was your diplomat.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, not exactly Kofi Annan, is it, in front of you? So so it started sort of like coming true, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, what's going on here? You know, this could get serious, but thankfully it all blew over and moved on.
You mentioned Coventry. I mean, what did it mean to have an opportunity to play in the Premier League?
Well, that was my goal right from the start. I wanted to play at the top. It took me a while to get there, but wherever I went, it was always that, you know, one thing I never did as a player was sort of rest on any laurels. I always tried to move the goalposts season to season, and you know, I just wanted to, you know, I enjoyed my time at Birmingham, and it came a little bit of a shock. We played Norwich in a semi-final League Cup, and I'd scored the winner in the last minute of extra time for us to go through, and we were due to play Leeds in the semi-final, and we had an opportunity then to go, but I was sold before me and Steve Claridge was sold before the actual semi-final. They must have, for whatever reason, we needed money, but Steve went to Leicester and I went to Coventry, and that was it. But the one thing, I was a Premier League player, and again in a different dressing room under a manager in Gordon Strachan and Ron Atkinson, who signed me. Gordon was his assistant, so I was in an environment of that had gone up another level in professionalism and better players, and it was great.
What was it like working for them too? Gordon's quite a dry character, isn't he?
It was brilliant working for them. Ron was larger than life, just as you see him, you would imagine. Although people put Big Ron as someone being flashy, he's a bit flash, but he's equally as, you know, comfortable being one of the lads. Great sense of humour. Gordon, very dry, could be very cutting. You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him. Thankfully, I got on well with him, and he liked me, and I got on. But Gordon was very, played with Gordon. He played when he was 40, and I played in, I think he'd become the oldest player. I think we were away at Spurs and he played, and still a great player, still a great player, looked after himself, you know. He taught me so much in a way of, you know, what a player should be, in a way, not just, I always try to look after myself off the pitch, but just his way of thought and in how he played the game. You know, a real special player, world class, really, when you think about it.
And the transfer fee at the time for you was over £1.5 million to go from Birmingham to Coventry. At the time, was you surprised it you cost that much money? Did you think it was worth that much money? Quite a lot of money, I guess, for a centre half at the time. But also, in modern times now, how much would you be worth?
I don't know. I know that. Leading into that, within the 2 years I was at Birmingham, there was a bit of interest that came out. Blackburn were interested, Bolton were interested. There was a lot of talk about Wimbledon, and there were this every time the same sort of figure came out. It was 1.5 to 1.7. So, you know, it was when I was skipper at at Birmingham. I'd had a couple of good years. My reputation had gone up. Cambridge, I'd had a few bad injuries that I'd got back from, but I sort of revitalised my, got my profile back up at Birmingham again, and was doing well. It wasn't just out of the blue. I knew something was going on. There was a couple of clubs interested. And then, obviously, Coventry weren't too far away from Birmingham as well, so I didn't really move. I stayed where I was, living in the city and of Birmingham. So, it was just up the road.
You moved up the leagues pretty quickly as a player. How did you find that step up in the opposition that you were facing and the pace of the game? You know, did you just play the same way?
No, you couldn't play the same way. Obviously, there was a lot more possession-based. But what I did find was... the concentration levels just went up massively, because as a defender, I found that you get away with things in the lower leagues. You know, if someone got the other side of you, you got no second chance in the Premier League. And what I found was, yes, it was a little bit quicker. They were more athletic, blah blah blah. But I found that, you know, I'd come off at games and not just physically but mentally I was shattered, and I'd come home and just fall asleep for the whole day leading up, or the whole week leading up to the game, and the game itself, you had to be switched on, and I think that was the difference, that you had to be on your game, because, you know, in that league, You give them a sniff and they'll take it, and that's it. You're a goal down, and so on that side of it, it was more of the concentration levels.
In your head, did you think that management was a route you wanted to go down when you stopped playing?
No, I retired through injury and moved back down south. Didn't think of anything that about management. I knew that I was still pretty fit physically. My knee wasn't up to full-time training for Premier League as well. Gordon had taken over at Coventry then, real big on fitness, and rightly so. But every time I pushed it, my knee just blew up. And being a centre-half, being the way I was built, I knew I had to keep on top of things and working hard. So, there was a decision to be made. I didn't want to go back to playing, with all respect, in League 2, League 1. I wanted to, I was close to being 30 then. I thought, right, this is the time maybe to do something else. So I moved back down south. I knew I could still play. I went and played part-time for Havant Waterlooville in the Dr. Martins League, which is a real competitive league. I enjoyed that. Played 2 years. Two or three years in there. After the first year, I was offered, would I be interested in being player manager? And I just sort of rolled into it, really. And I don't know whether someone saw that maybe, I'd captain teams and had a bit of a few leadership skills in my locker. And it became sort of progression, and I just rolled into it and then started to really enjoy it. Tough going from Premier League to non-league. How to deal with where you notice what a Premier League player's mentality is, and then you're suddenly dealing with a non-league player. That was hard. I should imagine, looking back, people probably looked at me as being some sort of ogre, and but it was just how I'd adjusted slowly but surely. Although I still haven't quite. But I think it's just standards what you want of yourself and what you try to demand off others. So that was a little bit of a transition and that, but I enjoyed my time at Havant Waterlooville playing and doing fairly well in the Dr. Martins League and Southern Premier.
For the latest reaction and reports from the games that matter, visit our website at kentonline.co.uk.
Those high standards that you set as a manager and your persona, the way that you carried yourself, did you find you got a reaction from the players straight away?
Yeah, they probably reacted. I don't know if it was in the right manner or the positive way, but I was always fair as a player in a way that I'd say how it was, but I didn't mean anything personally by it. It was just how I just wanted players to give their all, and but nothing was carried over, and there was a few players that probably couldn't deal with it, and. And that's probably, but that's no different to any manager. I think some players connect with you, and some players, maybe it's just a bit too much. I was in it to win. I've always played sport for the competitive side and win. I've never played sport or been involved in sport just to keep fit. And it's always been, that's the reason I'm involved in it. And so it was that winning streak in me, maybe, that I just try to put in others, and some take it on board and some don't, but I've always had good relationships with players when I've met up with them before. They probably get it a little bit now as they got older.
If my memory's sketchy or not, Liam, but at the time that Havant team, was that the way you passed the ball out from the back? Didn't you play it along, try to play it through midfield quite a lot in that time, didn't you?
We had a good side there at Havant, at Dr. Martin's level. There were some good ex-pros. We passed it. We were direct when we can, but I think we were a decent side. We nearly went up from the Dr. Martin's league to the conference. It was only, we were flying, and then we had this terrible weather, and we didn't play for I think it was like something like 6 weeks, and then suddenly we got a backlog of just games after, and non-league, you're struggling to play Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, and that's what killed us in the end. But I had some real good times there, and it was a good baptism of football management for me.
our paths first crossed when you came to Welling initially as a coach under Paul Parker. When Parks left, you took over as caretaker manager for four games. You won three, drew one, which means you've probably got the highest win percentage of any Welling manager, and probably ever will be. So you're probably the greatest Welling manager sitting next to me at the moment. What was your recollection of that time?
That was really strange, strange experience. Parks knew me from Chelmsford, when he was at Chelmsford, and I was at Havant, always had mutual respect for Paul, and I wasn't doing anything, and I got a phone call from him and asked if I would go and help him. So I went and helped, became his assistant. They were in a bit of a bad way. We steadied the ship, got a run of results, started getting a bit of belief, brought a few players in, decent lads, started turning things around. And then Parks stood down and left me with the reins. And as I say, we've got three wins, drawn. I think, hello, I might have a chance for a job here. And the two brothers then was Barry and Graham. So I'm waiting and waiting. I'm thinking, he's interviewing all these other people that are coming through the doors. And I'm thinking, well, what's going on here then? And he came. I always remember. He said to me, right, I suppose I better interview you then. And I thought then straight away that I don't think I'm going to get this job. And I think he gave it to AD Pennock, I think, at the time. Obviously, being a Kent lad, I mean, there was a lot of talk about, well, he lives on the south coast. Well, that was never their problem. That was my problem, but that was never their problem. It was never had been a problem. So there was, I think it was a sort of like the Kent thing that they wanted a Kent man in there or whatever. But strange situation, strange at that time, a strange club. It was weird. It was like it was their club, Barry and Graham's club. It was their club, and it to an extent where it was, you go upstairs and it was more. It was like gathering on with all the cakes and the. And the sandwiches with pots of tea, and it was like a, and I'd come in and go, well, no one was interested in really talking about the game, but they did serve a lovely slice of Victoria sponge though.
Irony of all ironies, then of course, a month down the line, and you ended up being manager of Gravesend and Northleigh. How did that come about?
Yeah, I think I remember someone told me Andy Ford had left. I think I made a phone call, put a CV in. Straight away, I got a phone call back from Brian Kilcullen, chairman at the time at Gravesend and Northfleet, who invited me up. Went and met him in the Dartford Hotel there, just by the bridge. Had one chat. He asked me if I could come back up again the following day in front of all the board. So I had the first chat with Brian, and then it came up next, and there was. Riley Edwards and Jason Botley and a few of the others, they were all around there, and it happened really quick. And before I knew it, I'd been offered the job, and and then I was in. It's full time, good club, some good players, and again, obviously, the job had come up for a reason because the results hadn't been the best. But yeah, it was the start of like the conference. Managing the conference, which was good standard, ex-league sides in there, so it was the start of it.
You ended up spending the largest chunk of your football career at Stonebridge Road. What was it about you and that club?
I don't know, I really don't know sometimes. So many different emotions, so many things to deal with. Pride, I think it was pride. I think pride in my own personal pride kept me going. Really enjoyed. So even coming through the door to start with, they'd going back to it, walk through the door with they had a good side, good non-league players. They had a vision to go full time. Non-league players were earning decent money for non-league players. But it was it was something had to change. You know, it was, we turned it round a little bit, went full time. But about that club and me, don't know. It was something that, I don't know, it's hard to put my finger on. I think it was just, I wouldn't say it was a stubbornness, but it was just a pride of, you know, again, I think it's like being, what's the word? We were a sort of lower end in that league, you know, we weren't a Stevenage or anything like that. And I enjoyed that, being, again, I go back to the siege mentality a little bit, you know, us against them or me against them. And, you know, I'm not going to get beaten on this. I'm not going to walk away, or I'm not going to throw my toys out the pram and that'll be it. It was like, no, you ain't getting rid of me, and I'm not walking out of here, because I think there's something that we can achieve. But there was lots of things that twists and turns regarding, you know, the my football club and things like that, and change of chairman, change of everything. You know, it was mental at times.
Looking back now, do you see some similarities with your experience at Cambridge to Ebbsfleet in terms of the size of the club they were up against?
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's like the what I was trying to put into words, that us against them, and that spirit that I enjoyed and created within the teams that I brought, because that's what was one of our biggest you know, things in our armour, was our spirit, our willingness, our never say die, our how we could bounce back from defeat, how we could, you know, how I could deal with the adversity. That was quite a motivation itself, how I could deal with this next challenge. You know, how could I do it? And it you know, what I dealt with there is, you know, I think I could deal with pretty much anything in life, you know, with that. And I did, you know, a lot of things happened personally as well at that football club, while I was at that football club. And, you know, they make years, you know, I could write a book on it.
You're best known, obviously, for Ebbsfleet, for winning the FA Trophy, an amazing achievement. How often do you think about that now? Does it still hold great memories for you?
Yeah, it does. You know, I think my time at Ebbsfleet, oh, it was great memories, good and bad times. They're all part of experience. I put life down as, you know, it's not just on the ascendancy. You're up, you're down, and it's all part of experiences of life. And you know, I'm really thankful for Gravesend and Northfleet and Ebbsfleet for giving me that, because I learnt a lot about myself. The trophy was the pinnacle, obviously, you know, seeing so much happiness and joy to people, and being able to be part of that and help bring that, you know, gives you amazing confidence and pride, and great, you know, something I'll always treasure, and fondness of that memory of winning in 2008. I think it was the first trophy final at the new Wembley, and something that'll never leave me, or can anyone take it away from me.
Talk about the day a bit more. What was the build-up like to the day when you stayed at the hotel, didn't you, trained at Bisham Abbey?
Yeah, the day, everything went clockwork over that trophy weekend, which is weird, because most weeks there was always something to deal with. For some reason, the whole thing went so smoothly. Oh, there was one thing that went wrong, but I'll tell you about that later. But, so I was left to pretty much arrange everything. So I wanted, I near enough booked the hotel, apart from things like coach hour and things like that, but I went down to Bluewater and arranged to get all the lads' suits, which I got for them, shoes. Done that, arranged to go to Bisham Abbey. Burnham Beaches we stayed at. The hotel was great. Got the food sorted, everything. So leading up to it, we travelled down. We went to Wembley on the way down. just for a look round. Then we went to our hotel. I think we stayed two nights. We got there late, stayed two nights, had a full day. Busham Abbey, the training was like spot on. I remember the training, coming off the train, we'd arranged how we were going to set the session out. And I remember it going it so smoothly and just so right. I picked the side, told the side, this was the side. The other lads that weren't involved, they were superb. The lads that weren't involved, which was massive. You know, there was no sulkers. They supported the lads that had got the shirts. The starting 11, the training went absolutely to plan, just went just unbelievable. You usually get, you know, where managers can be pulling their hair out and get, but it just went so smoothly. Went back, the food was great. I remember I went and played golf in the afternoon before, came back, the lads were all chilled out on the on the lawn at Burnham Beaches. Good evening meal. Everyone went to bed fine, blah, blah, blah. It just went so great, you know. And then obviously the win just capped it all off. But the whole preparation just went to plan and I couldn't believe it. And, you know, as I say, any other time in there, there was always something to deal with. The only thing that really messed up was I was due to play golf and I did specifically say to my kit man, Morris Cox, do not drive the coach back to Wembley to set the kit up because it's got more golf clubs on it. And what did he do? Did exactly the opposite, like Morris did do, just to be Morris. So when I'm there all ready to get me golf clubs, they're at Wembley and I'm waiting at Burnham, so I had to hire a set of golf clubs for that afternoon. But yeah, apart from that, it was great.
Did you play well or not?
Yeah, even played well at golf. So no, it's great. Me and Alan Kimball went and played golf and as I say, came back. The whole preparation was superb.
Coming off the back of Wembley, winning the trophy and all the buzz that was around the club at the time, when you look back, do you think that was a big opportunity for the Ebbs Fleet to kick on?
Yeah, it was, and it was sorely missed. We had the momentum, we had it all going, but I think, you know, without going into detail, that, you know, I know a certain amount, but I think any income from the trophy, and we earned quite a bit of money, I think, that was already earmarked for the paying off for takeovers and things like that. So that was gone. There wasn't a lot. We had a little bit of an increase in the budget afterwards, but people failed to remember. After that trophy win, I lost Akindi, McPhee and Boswick, which, you know, three big players that it's hard to replace. Now, if you could have kept them and built on them, you know, who knows? But, you know, that's by the by now.
The John Akindi deal, you basically did that single-handedly, didn't you? It fell to you to make that all happen.
Yeah, it was. Even though we had a chief exec and a chairman, it was basically left to me to go and sort out the finances and try and broker the deal, which we did, and we got a good deal in the end, I thought. You know, I think after the trophy, I think the recruitment was poor. You know, we needed someone that could actually take the club really further forward and have some sort of vision. And there wasn't a vision. It was basically people were coming with that were recruited on good money as well, with no background in football. Of the industry, and you know, it was just it was a chance sorely missed. Really, I think we just missed that momentum. That every now and then something comes along and you've got to grab it and you've got to, you know, really nurture it and go, right, this is it. We've got it. We've got something. We've got the momentum. We've got the support of base. We've got everything. We've got the membership. With 30,000, we've just won a trophy at Wembley in front of 45,000 or whatever it was, and we just missed it. We just, you know, it was all down to, yes, I agree that you need, you know, it's about what goes on the pitch, but also you need what goes, an infrastructure around it, you know, of what we're going to do, what's the plan, what is the vision, and you know, it just dwindled away. And then obviously the membership dwindled away with my football club. People got bored with with dealing with the politics, so they'd leave, and amongst all that, I was stuck in the middle with, you know, talking to new chairman, a new board. Then they get bored of being on the board, and then you're speaking to someone else. And it just got, you know, just went, and just such a shame.
I bet no other manager in the league had a job that was anything like yours, really.
No, not at the time. I'm sure, you know, there's. I know all managers have some sort of drama to deal with, but not on the scale I had. I mean, there was just no leadership. You know, I was trying to run a team on. You know, I think the year after that, the budget did go, and we were dealing with, you know, young kids then that on peanuts, although they still wanted to be full time. People wouldn't let go of the My Football Club, but then there was no income, and it just got ridiculous. And in the end, you're swimming upstream without a paddle, and it got really tough.
Was there ever a time that you thought My Football Club would work?
I think it could have worked. Yeah, I think, you know, when I first met Will Brooks, who was the founder of it, and Tim, you know, great guys, had a good idea, but they were the got things that they didn't own My Football, or they sold it to the club, the idea, but they, because it was the way it was set out and the mechanics of it, no one could actually make one decision. No one could decide, boom, that's going, you know, everything had to be, and the process of it took so long, and there was always someone that would moan about this, or you could never move on and make a real decision. I had no problem with the, you know, the votes and things like that, but it was, you know, things like putting up players, what you were going to put players' salaries at and what they were earning and things like that. And there was a lot of where I just said, no, you can't do that. You know, it's against employment law, you know, privacy. You can't do that. And it just become, you know, the more you fed the My Football Club, regarding where, the more they wanted. And in the end, you sort of like got, you know, you were just in this paralysis of doing anything.
So were there discussions about those owners, which are basically people on the other end of a computer or a phone, picking the team? How far along did that actually go?
Well, listen, when the picking of the team and all that, that was the main selling point for the 30,000. And I never once turned around and said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not that. I always said, look, if they want me to do it, I'll do it. But when it actually come down to the nitty gritty of actually picking the team, they didn't want to do it. It went over to, no, well, Liam's better because he knows the players, he's seen them in training and all that. So I suppose looking back, I think probably what Will and Tim wanted me to do was really promote that. I wouldn't promote it, but I didn't say I wouldn't do it. But I think they really wanted me to promote it. Come on, pick the team. He's playing great at right back this week. He's doing great at centre forward. I think we've got an injury, but I think you should, you know, they wanted all that. And I just couldn't encourage. I had too much on my, I was dealing with trying to coach and prepare teams for Saturday than sitting on a laptop, giving out information, and just, it's, you know, like, it's like a social media, start of a real social media thing, really, where just giving out information, and then they go, oh, yeah, let's vote on this, let's vote on that. And it was, you know, it's, yeah, I didn't have the time or the inclination to start promoting someone picking the team for me. If they wanted to do it, I never said, no problem. But when it actually come to it, they were quite happy with me doing it.
By the time the membership had dwindled, how draining was that a process for you as manager?
That was really draining. Tough. I remember that year we went down, and we had a right go at it, to be fair. We had a right go at it. We hang in there right into the last bit. And to be fair, we went down by default. And the one thing that sticks in my throat about, or a bad taste in my mouth is we was Chester's demise. So Chester started the league. The Football League members of the conference members voted Chester in. They all knew that there was a problem with their finances. They voted them in. And then halfway through the season, when teams have taken, because they started quite strong, Chester, we'd taken 3 points but still had a game to play at home. So we'd had 3 points, plus we was possible another 3 points. Teams that had played them early on, like we had lost points often. And what happened was it went to the league. The members came back together again and voted whether to kick them out. And in the end, the members voted to kick them out. So we basically lost 6 points. So all points got abolished and taken off them. The sticking point for me was we voted, Ebbsfleet United voted to kick them out. And really, I was saying, listen, whatever happens, you keep them in, vote at least to try and keep them in, because we've got 6 points here. But whether it was down to naivety or whatever, they went the other way, which really, you know, left a sour taste in my mouth.
You mentioned all these sorts of challenges that you had away from the pitch, but on the pitch, the end of that season when you got relegated, the squad broke up and you had to rebuild and start again in Conference South. How did you even start to begin that process, and how did you bring success to the club?
Just doing what I did before. I remember when we turned full time. So this was before the trophy. We went full time, and I just got these as many. I arranged like loads of lads just to come in, and it was like a little. It was sort of like an X Factor. So at the end of it, you'd basically say, yes, I'd like you to come back, or no, you're not for me. And you whittled it down and down and down. And we got the likes of people like Ross Smith then and Mark the Boller, and there was other player, I can't remember who they were now, but we got these players in. And then after that year when we did go down after the trophy, did exactly the same. You know, we went back to part-time, which was easier. So in a way that it suited us, we could... get players that were part-time, we could give them a decent wage, and we, because of the area we're in, because to be fair, you know, it's a great catchment area around that South East London way, and you know, we built a side, got a good blend, Callum Willett, Ashley Carew, players like that, obviously Clint Easton, good spine, good lads, Preston Edwards, Stoney came back, Joe Howe, you know, lads that just wanted a trial came in, yeah, come in, yeah, there's something about you I like, and just had an eye for it and got assembled a side together, and bounced straight back, which was something that was an achievement in itself, a real achievement, I think.
So to be stood on the pitch at Farnborough with the trophy after the playoff final, given where you'd started that season, how much satisfaction did you take from that?
Yeah, I remember, I think, you know, Paul Lorraine was my skipper, great skipper for me. You know, I had some strong conversations, but, you know, me and Loro sometimes bounce off him a little bit, and he, you know, clash a little bit, but I loved him because he'd give you everything. But standing there with him with the trophy and that, you know, it was like a little bit of the two-finger to what had happened before with the Chester thing, and I think that really drove me on, you know, and it was a little bit, again, go back to the... them and us, you know, siege mentality, sort of that's always been my, I don't know, whether it's a bit of anger, bitterness, whatever, turning it into some sort of motivation to go and stick two fingers up to, you know, the establishment a little bit.
And of everything that had gone before, your final season at Ebbsfleet, probably more difficult than anything else you probably had in your whole career. Remind us what that was like going through it.
I think that was when it got really the worst, I think. It just, no training ground, no facilities, players not getting paid, no leadership behind the scenes, a lot of backstabbing, a lot of lost trust in people around me. or people that I'd worked for. Didn't know where the club was going. Just wanted to keep the players focused. I went and really sided with them then, in a way that, like, you know, lads, come on, just for your own pride. And you know, if they'd have turned around and said to me, I can't do this, I'm going, I'd have said, yeah, no problem, I understand, you know. So that was the hardest thing, and that was the hardest season, I think. And to be fair, I'd been there 8 years, and probably it come to the end of my time now, because I was tired, been through a lot. I don't think I had the energy. I needed a break, and I needed a break from it. I wasn't getting the support, as I say, lots and lots going on behind the scenes, a lot of bitching, backbiting, backstabbing, the whole lot. The only people that sort of kept me going were my immediate staff, and that was the likes of, you know, Macca, Ron Hilliard, Morris Cox, when he was there, and just sort of like that was how we got through it, really. But it was really tough.
Paul McCarthy, Macca had played for you as your captain, then he worked as your number two, and so there weren't many other people to lean on, really, were there? So I guess the two of you, you know, became close out of necessity and having to stick together.
Yeah, it was like that. You know, Macca realised what was going on. He knew what was going on and what I was going through. Supported me as much as he could, but you know, I think you can only support someone so much, and it got really difficult. You know, being away from home as well. You know, spent a lot of time on motorways and driving back and in hotel rooms and trying to work out how you're gonna turn things around, and you know, are we gonna get the wages paid, and am I gonna deal with this tomorrow, and you know, what's going on behind me, what are they telling me the truth and things like that. So I had to deal with a lot, but Macca was great for me, and you know, he knew what was going on. He was no mug, and we still had a relationship where we could, if we were away on a trip or whatever, we could sit and have a couple of pints together and just sort of mull it over and end up laughing about it a little bit sometimes, because that's the only, it got to the stage when that's the only thing you could do.
Mm. How hard was it to lose him a couple of years ago?
Yeah, it's still think about him every now and then, and just blew me away when I got the phone call from caretaker, telling me, you know, and it was like, listen, he'd ring me, Colin, and say every now and then, and say, you know, oh, do you remember, you know, was it Tony the steward when he died, and or someone, it was always like some of the old boys that you might have, you know, worked around the club. And then when I got the phone call, I think, oh, who's this? It's got, you know, who's this now? It's one of someone else. But when he said his name, you know, I just couldn't get me head around it. I had to stop the car. Yeah, very sad.
You mentioned how much of a toll it had taken on you being at Ebbsfleet over those 8 years. You got to the end of that season, and the club had gone down and were just about to go pop, really, weren't they? And the takeover happened with Dr. El Hamady, and Peter Varney came in, and it was announced that you were leaving by mutual consent. How did that conversation go? There's a lot of people have asked me over the years, or said, I wonder what it would have been like if Liam had stayed. Was there any part of you that was wanting to carry on?
To be fair, what happened was, I mean, I still had a year on my contract. So we got that. We'd gone down the basically the back end of the season was just about trying to raise money for the club to pay off VAT or whatever. We get to a stage, and I remember, I think it was Jessica McQueen came in and said, there could be new owners, great new owners. And then it all went a little bit quiet, and I get a phone call that, could you come up and meet the new owners? The new owners are coming. I think it was from Jessica, actually. And I said, yeah, no problem. And I didn't even read it, really. I didn't read the situation at all. So I went to the club, went into that little port cabin that they built at the inn where they had done a bit of hospitality. I went in there and I could sense that Jessica was sat there, and she was the chairwoman at the time, and she looked ever so sad. She said, can I have a chat with you? And she sort of like sounded me out, and I just said, yeah, okay, no problem, okay. Walked in. It was pretty much very, very professional. It was very right, we're going this way, this is your so-and-so, we'll sort this out, what does this cost, this is what you're going to do with the car, do you, you know, blah blah blah, pretty cut and dried. And I drove away there and thought, well, that's it, that's 8 years of my life, that's finished now, that chapter's over. And it was literally that quick. Nothing else there. Never, and that was the end of it. There was no, you know, I went around and said a few goodbyes to people, but at that time there weren't many staff around the club. It wasn't full time. There wasn't many people around. And that was the end. That's how football moves, and you move on, and it moved on very quickly. And that was, you know, they said they were, I think that, did they say that they were going another way? Personnel wise, I can't remember, to be honest. It was that quick, it was that to the point. You know, Peter Varney was there, I think his solicitor was there, the takeover solicitor that was there, and that was it, done and dusted, see you later.
Did you drive away thinking that this is the right thing for Liam Daish at this point in time?
Do you know what, be honest, probably did a little bit. It was like, I was never going to just walk away. You know, spent 8 years, put a lot in. I wasn't going to make, because the way I got to, you know, I keep going back to this siege mentality, but it got to a point where I thought, no, I ain't going to make someone else's job easy for them. You know, they want me to, but I ain't going to do it. I've put too much time, effort, gone through unbelievable experiences up there, and I'm not going to just walk away and allow someone. Just go, oh, that was Andy. He's walked away. Big, you know, he's gone. Don't have to do that. I thought, no, if you're going to do it, you know, at least have the guts to do it. And but it was very, very straightforward. They honoured the last year of my contract, which rightly so, I think. And, you know, and that was it.
What have you made of Ebbsfleet since you left, and the ups and then the downs and the turbulence you want that's been there since?
Well, it seems to have come full circle, hasn't it? Looking at it, when, you know, what they were spending on players, a lot of, just like anything, you know, when the money dries up, you see people disappear, don't you? You know, suddenly resign from boards, resign from this. Well, they've obviously been on a wage. So, you know, I find it quite laughable, actually, and, you know, that people's money was spent, you know, rightly or wrongly, and the figures I'm hearing, you know, is just unbelievable, really. I mean, I've, even down to my own manager at Portsmouth came and asked me, they're paying this at, players are being paid this at Ebbsfleet, really? I said, well, that's the room, because he'd inquired about over a couple. So, you know, at the end of the day, it sounds like it was a bit of a plaything, and it's suddenly it's now novelty's worn off. They get bored with it, and it goes back to, and it's come full circle. But I suppose the good thing is that maybe whatever has happened, they've got some facilities out of it with the new stand or whatever's been built around there. So, you know, back to the real world.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
On to the quickfire questions, Liam. Start with a simple one. I guess you've been a winner at Wembley a couple of times. What's the best thing about winning at Wembley?
Best thing, the final whistle. Final whistle, I think. And obviously, when you... I enjoyed management. That was good at it. But I think the playing at Wembley and winning was great. But yeah, I think the final whistle, the emotion that you're going through through the 90 minutes is great. But once that whistle's blown and you've won, it's just the feeling is just overtakes you.
Which one was better then, managing or playing?
I have to say managing. I've got to say managing, haven't I? Yeah. Managing was good because you're responsible for a group of people instead of just one person. You know, as I said earlier, that just giving that enjoyment to so many people and seeing so many ecstatic faces, and you're responsible for that, or partly responsible for that, I think is something else.
Known as a very tough defender to play against. Has there ever been a time in football, maybe on playing or when you've gone into managing, when there's been a situation that you've been almost afraid of in a way?
No, not afraid of any. Fearful of. You know, am I going to get these? How do I turn this round? But no, it's all an experience and how you deal with it. But no, I don't think I've ever been afraid in any sort of football environment or scenario experience. Never been afraid, no.
Best goal you've ever scored?
Best goal. I didn't score many, but I think it was two really that really stick out. One at what I talked about at Norwich in the League Cup last minute. But also when we went up at Birmingham, it was a Tuesday night game between us and Brentford. They were first, they were second, and I scored a goal in front of a full house at St Andrews that literally sort of, I think, clinched the championship for us.
I'm guessing a bullet header?
It was, yeah. They're all most hilly headers, yeah.
Back to your playing days, who was your best partner at centre-half?
I had some decent ones. I played alongside some good ones when I was involved in international. I played alongside Paul McGrath, which was an unbelievable experience. Made my debut alongside David O'Leary. Club-wise, played alongside some real good centre-halves. Richard Shaw at Coventry was a great player. And Dave Barnett at Birmingham. But I think over a time I had a centre half I played at Cambridge with Phil Chappell, who was completely the opposite to me in everything, you know, how we looked, how we acted, how we behaved, everything. But for some reason we did complement each other.
Who was your toughest opponent, the centre forward who gave you the most problems?
They all gave me problems, Steve. No, I've played against the one thing I'd like to say. I played against some real legends in the game. All of them had a different side that they could cause me problems with. But I think the one that stood out was played at Man United and against Eric Cantona, and I was in awe of the man. You know, what a player! What physique! Could do anything. But. There were some great players I played against. Played all again in that time, you know, with the Shearers, Fergusons, Fowlers, you know, Coles. You know, they're all good. But I think the King sticks out.
Did he talk to you during the game?
No, he just gives you the look every now and then, and that's enough.
A couple as a manager then. Who do you think was your best signing?
Best signing? I think, looking back, Charlie McDonald was a snip. On a free from Crawley, he went on and had a good career. I think Chris McPhee was a great player, could play in any position. Played him right back once, he was the best player on the pitch. Play him wing back, could play him inside as a 10, could play him as a 9, could play him in midfield. We had some good players in there, we signed some good players, you know, developed players, moved them on. Gave them a little bit of a, I used to call us a bit of a rehab club, where players that had either lost interest, been kicked out, whatever, come on, get back in here, you can come in with us, get your career back on track, if you're doing well, you'll go. Michael Boswick was a great signing. And he was only, I only had him, he was a baby when I had him, 18, 19. I think, well, I tell you what, I used to really get a lot of satisfaction from the lads that come through the youth team, the likes of Luke Moore, Michael West, John Akindi. So I think that, you know, for that little academy there, produced some good players.
And we saw you have some terrific ding-dongs with rival managers on the touchline. Which of those battles do you sort of look back on and think, oh yeah, that was a good scrap?
Well, some I had a few ding-dongs with and a few words, but it never lasted that long. But the one that always used to get, you know, that I used to love winding up and he couldn't, you know, was Steve Evans. He was just, I remember me and Macca and Ron used to sit there at Crawley. The one thing that our record against Crawley was different class. I think we only lost one game in about 8 or 9. But we used to like sitting there, especially at their place, either taking points or nicking a draw and winding him up, because he used to get himself in such a state.
Finally then, your best Barry Fry story?
Barry Fry story. I remember we would go away and there was a player, Jonathan Hunt, and so we're in the champ, we're pushing to win the title, and Jonathan, we had a player called Jonathan Hunt who was a good footballer, but he wasn't the bravest. And this is just one of many, and there'd be plenty more. But I remember him ducking out of a challenge, and Barry Fry in front of, I can't remember if it was at home or away, runs the whole length of the touchline, doing a chicken impression, right in front of her, and everyone's just sort of like stopped, and looked as if to, you know, it's like, he's gone insane. It was like, where's the white coats to come and take him away? He was literally flapping his arms, clucking like a chicken, because one of our players had sort of, but it was like, it was horrendous.
Time, as always, has beaten us and caught up. We've absolutely enjoyed the last hour and a bit, looking back over your career, your managerial highs and the odd low at Ebbsfleet. But thanks very much for your time and your honesty.
Brilliant, thanks, and safe journey home to you, lads.
Just one more goodbye as well. Steve, your final podcast. Thanks very much, and hope you've enjoyed it.
I have, and I'll be listening from the other side of the world from now on. So cheers, Matt, and thanks to everyone who's come in. Great guests. It's been a privilege. So cheers and goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the KM Football Podcast. Click subscribe at Audio Boom and iTunes, and keep up to date with the latest stories at kentonline.co.uk.